way. And besides, Wister bleated on, as all civilized beings recognize, violence never settles anything. All at once, Avram decided she'd had enough. Carried beyond a certain point, stupidity was personally offensive to her. Tell that to the Confederate States of America and the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Assemblywoman Wister, she cut in. If that is, you can find them. Wister looked blank. The liberal progressive party that ruled Nova Terra had long since reduced the teaching of history to an elective. Obviously, Wister had never so elected, and she had no idea what Avram was talking about. But some others in the committee room failed to altogether smother their laughter, and no one reprimanded the Sky Marshal. Hannah Avram could get away with quite a lot by trading on her record. Her fame from the Theban War stood second only to that of Ivan Antonov, now rusticating in retirement on Novaya Rodina. Avram chuckled inwardly at the memory of some of the things Ivan the Terrible had said out loud in this place. Wister would be hiding under the table if he were here. The thought encouraged her to exploit the pause she'd created. "I invite the committee to recall Captain Cheltwin's report. Commodore Braun implemented full-com protocols despite the unarguable fact that the aliens had deliberately lured him into a trap. In fact, such protocols are automatic in first-contact situations and cover the entire spectrum of possible frequencies. But by definition, it takes two to communicate. At no time have these unknowns evinced any response other than automatic, unreasoning, and lethal hostility. Under the circumstances, the on-scene commanders have behaved in the only manner possible, and I stand squarely behind their actions." Her eyes scanned the entire committee, finally settling on the chairman. Agamemnon Waldeck of New Detroit peered back at her from between rolls of fat. He had the features that typified his clan of corporate world magnates, almost obscured in his case by blubber.
"All very well, Sky Marshal," he rumbled. "But what about Admiral Villiers' loss of Golan? Shouldn't he have been able to hold a warp point against an anticipated attack?"
"Yes," Wister honked. "We should set up a special subcommittee to investigate the military establishment's inexcusable failure to defend our citizens. Mr. Chairman, the people have a right to know the facts behind this, and no cover-up can be permitted to—"
Avram's attention didn't stray from Waldeck's porcine little eyes. Wister was merely contemptible, but the chairman rated a certain respect as a villain. He knew perfectly well that Howard Anderson himself couldn't have held Golan. He was just pandering to the electorate's needs to believe that any bad news from the front could only be the result of uniformed incompetence. So when she spoke, addressing him directly and ignoring Wister, she didn't even bother to mention the impossible circumstances and overwhelming odds Villiers had faced.
"Aren't we forgetting something, Mr. Chairman?" Her voice was of normal volume, but something in it cut Wister off in mid-vaporing. "Aren't we forgetting the time-lapse involved?"
"I'm afraid I don't quite follow you. That permit me to spell it out. Only 12 standard Terran days elapsed between the attack on Survey Flotilla 27 and the fall of Golan. In other words, what invaded Golan, 2 dozen super dreadnoughts for starters, was this enemy's idea of a quick reaction force." Waldeck's normally florid face paled.
"You mean—"
Avram nodded.
"Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have to ask ourselves what we'll be facing when the enemy has mobilized." She let the silence stretch before adding, "In fact, for all we know, Admiral Villiers may already be facing it."
"Transit completed, sir," Captain Yu reported, as the sky of Erebor settled into focus. Commodore Reichman nodded complacently. "Good crossing time for these tubs, Wang. Shape a course for Planet A2. But, of course, check in with Admiral Villiers at once." "Aye, aye, sir. Admiral Villiers has a picket just off this warp point. Should only be a short time delay in hailing her and receiving acknowledgement."
While Yu turned aside and spoke to his comm officer, Reichman studied the system display. Erebor A's Type K orange companion sun was 50 light-minutes away. This wasn't a very widely separated binary, and it was lucky to have planets. Equally lucky was that a system so young— Component A was a Type F, had given birth to life. In fact, it had done so twice, though Component B's heavy, dense-atmosphered second planet was no place for humans. The little orange secondary sun was ignorable, as was the system's third warp point,
leading to the cul-de-sac system of Seldon, for the outpost there had already been evacuated. His goal lay ahead, the white glare of Erebor A moving into the center of the view screen. "Commodore," Yu's voice brought him abruptly out of his musings. "We've contacted the picket, and, sir, there's already a battle going on here."
Chapter 5. Buying Time. Admiral Villiers had gotten his first surprise when the enemy emerged into Erebor. He'd been sitting on Rattlesnake's flag bridge. The flagship had happened to be among the third of his units that were currently at GQ. There'd be no pinnaces to warn of an attack this time, and TF-58 had been on rotating general quarters for a Terran month. So there'd been a full bridge crew on hand as he'd studied the tactical display and wished for the thousandth time for the mine layer support he'd repeatedly and urgently requested. With fields of mines, actually cheap homing missiles with only a dash capability, covering the warp point, he would have slept a lot better lately. As it was, he had to struggle to keep haggardness from encroaching on his almost dandyish norm. Still, he couldn't complain about the support Fleet had managed to push through to Erebor. His task force was now up to 17 battleships and battle cruisers, 10 light carriers, and 18 cruisers and destroyers. An impressive augmentation of his strength by any standard, except the one that mattered, the numbers and tonnage he knew he would have to face. So he and Rear Admiral Jackson Teller, who'd arrived in Erebor a week ago, had settled on a variation of the delaying tactics he'd used at Golan. Once again, the carriers with their escorting battle cruisers and lighter units were positioned to cover the warp point with their fighters, which now numbered 149. Not full complements for his 10 Shokaku-class light carriers, but still better than what he'd had in Golan. And better armed, for the antimatter munitions he'd received had included the far more lethal FRAM variant of the FR-1. After they'd inflicted the maximum possible destruction on the leading attack waves, Villiers would advance with his battle line to extreme missile range. It was a terrifying gamble, for he would be facing super dreadnought-sized leviathans, and analysis of the sensor data from Golan had told him things he didn't want to know about their armament. Some could hurl equivalents of the TFN's capital missiles, superior to any of his in range and destructive capability. Others mounted capital ship force beam projectors that could reach out to missile ranges with wrenching, disrupting tractor beams that oscillated between positive and negative attraction in microsecond bursts. But Villiers, relying on his superior fire control technology, would duel with his mammoth opponents until his magazines were empty, then use his superior speed and the harassment value of his fighters to beat a fighting retreat across the system to Erebor A2, which he devoutly hoped would stand empty, its colonists already evacuated by Commodore Reichman's transports, which ought to be arriving any time now. With the thought came, unbidden, the memory of his address to the Golan refugees just before their departure to what he still dared hope was the safety of the Sarasota system. He hadn't wanted to do it. He never felt comfortable dealing with civilians. But his officers' eyes had told him clearly enough what they thought of his avoidance of the massed human misery in the lower decks, and when the transports had come, he'd said a few words to the children and pregnant women who were being taken off his hands. He'd wanted to be reassuring, but knew beyond any possibility of self-deception that he hadn't been. As he forced himself to remember the scene, his recollections narrowed to a single face, a face in which Castilian blended with Aztec. The pregnant young woman had stood holding a blonde, blue-eyed toddler that couldn't possibly have been her own, and her face had worn an expression Villiers could not forget. It was in his mind's eye at the instant the alarm klaxon sounded. He thrust that face out of his mind, along with the leaden thought, "Reichman's not here yet," and stood up with the briskness of invincible habit. He turned to face Santos, and the expression on the chief of staff's face stopped him with his mouth half open. "Sir," Santos said, with the kind of impassivity that set off alarm bells in anyone who knew him, "I think you'd better have a look at the readouts from the pickets." Villiers did so. At first, what he was seeing didn't even register. When it did, his immediate thought was, "Instrument malfunction."
but a lifetime's mental discipline didn't let that denial reflex survive for even an instant. He knew that what he was seeing was an accurate report of what was happening at the warp point that led to Golan and Hell. The forces that roil in the maelstrom of a warp point have never been fully understood, but their effects are understood all too well. In that vortex of the unknowable, conservation of momentum loses its meaning, which means there can be no such thing as formation flying through a warp point. Ever since the dawn of interstellar flight, the first principle of safety, indeed of sanity, had been that ships transited one at a time. Simultaneously transiting ships could emerge in any sort of relationship to each other, including that of occupying the same space. This, of course, was impossible, and people who commit impossibilities tend to come to very bad ends. Villiers, like every naval officer, took the principle so completely for granted that for the first split second his mind simply rejected what the sensors and his eyes had reported. Light cruiser-sized ships, 36 of them, materializing simultaneously in that Type 1 warp point. Of course, not all of them remained material for very long. 8 hostiles interpenetrated on emergence, sir, Santos reported in a monotone. He didn't waste words describing what had happened to those 8 ships. Villiers scanned the readouts of the energy releases involved and wondered what those 4 explosions, what an inadequate word, had done to the communications and sensor capabilities of the other 28 hostiles. They must be robots, Frankel breathed. At any other time, Villiers would have slapped him down for uttering rot. The early computer age's forecasts of artificial intelligence, like those of direct neural interfacing, had proven over-optimistic to the point of giddiness. Time and again, autonomous robotic combat units had lasted precisely as long as it had taken them to come up against opposition directed by a trained and motivated sentient brain. Villiers, like the rest of the military, had long since written off as chimerical the dream nightmare of eliminating the human, or equivalent, element from war. But surely no living beings could have crewed those ships. He forced himself to concentrate on studying the overall tactical picture, while resisting the temptation to fire off signals that would only distract people who had their orders and knew their jobs. And they were doing those jobs as well as could be expected, considering the stunning surprise that had been heaped atop the fatigue of a month spent alternating between general quarters and mere alert status. The fighters of the combat space patrol swooped in and launched as the invaders tried to bend their randomized vectors into some kind of organized formation. Ships as small as light cruisers had no business trying to absorb the fury of antimatter warheads. One after another, they died in that hellish glare. But not without taking toll, for the foe had learned from what had happened in Golan. The anti-fighter fire, while still far short of TFN standards, had improved significantly enough for the difference to fairly leap out of the raw data. More fighters were dying than even Villiers' worst-case estimates had allowed for at this stage of the battle. Before the last of the invasion's vanguard had been destroyed, the surviving fighters had exhausted their missiles, and much of the task force was still struggling to come to full readiness. The Admiral gazed at the columns of figures and the swarming lights in the master plot's holotank and saw his plan lying in ruins. The CSP's survivors had just turned to return to their carriers to rearm, and the other carriers were not yet prepared to launch when the first super dreadnought emerged from the warp point. It was alone. Evidently not even this enemy could afford to treat those huge ships as expendable, and there were no more lunatic simultaneous transits. And Villiers turned to Santos and proceeded to exceed even his usual capacity for studied understatement.
We appear, Commodore, to be faced with an unanticipated gap in our fighter coverage of the warp point. We must therefore make adjustments to our plan.
The battle line will advance. The assault fleet had done its work. As the super-dreadnought oriented itself, its sky-sweeping sensors revealed that the anticipated little attack craft had exhausted their armament in reducing the light cruisers of the initial transit to the handful that survived, and were now withdrawing their tenders. The enemy battle line, the same sort of ships as before, little more than 2/3 as massive as a super-dreadnought,
but more of them this time, as was to be expected, was closing to within standard missile range. It would be necessary to induce them to narrow the range even more. Villiers' outward impassivity, so habitual as to be unconscious, was now a dike holding back a rising flood of despair. His battle lines, finely orchestrated salvos of antimatter missiles, had done fearful damage to the oncoming super-dreadnoughts. But those implacable behemoths continued to come and come and come, and each of them mounted massed arrays of point defense that made it a difficult target even without the ability to coordinate its anti-missile fire with that of its fellows. And these enemies were of the class that mounted capital force beams. Those weapons' destructiveness was attenuated at this range, but there were a lot of them, and Villiers' battleships began to take damage that felt like a rending and tearing at his own guts. After an interval that seemed far longer than it was, the reserve carriers finally began to launch their fighters. A small cheer arose on the flag bridge at the news, and Santos cursed the young jackasses under his breath and braced himself for thunderbolts from the admiral's station. A full heartbeat passed before he realized that they hadn't come. Suddenly concerned, the chief of staff turned and stared at the admiral, who hadn't moved. Concern growing, he stepped over to Villiers' side. "Sir?" Villiers turned his command chair to face him. For a shocking instant, Santos saw behind that face, saw the full depths of the hell in which the admiral's soul now dwelt, and he spoke as he'd never thought he'd live to speak to Anthony Villiers. "It's not going to be enough, is it, sir?" A tiny smile caused Villiers' mustache to twitch upward. "No, it isn't, Raoul." At any other time, the use of his first name would have sent Santos into shock. Now, like so much else, it didn't seem to matter very much. "The fighters will do a lot of damage, but I think I'm learning how these beings think. They send in what they know will be an overwhelming force, and accept whatever losses it takes to secure the objective. They sent 2 dozen super-dreadnoughts into Golan, and we gave them a good fight. So they'll send in at least 2 or 3 times that here. They'll just keep coming and coming." He shook his head slowly. "Our options have narrowed to withdrawing now, or—" His voice trailed to a halt, and Santos wondered what he was thinking. "Of course," Villiers resumed, "the decision would be an easy one if only Commodore Reichman had gotten here—" "Sir!" The cry from the comm station seemed to shatter a glass case around Villiers and Santos. "The picket at the K-45 warp point reports that Commodore Reichman's ships have begun to enter the system." Once again, there was a muted cheer. Villiers and Santos stood apart from it. But then Villiers stood up straight. He seemed to slough off his despairing indecision. But Santos, eyeing him narrowly, saw that only the indecision was gone. The despair was still there. "Well," the admiral spoke, with a ghastly caricature of his old briskness. "That settles that, eh? Have Comrade's admiral tell her.
Sir, you don't have to do this."
Rear Admiral Jackson Teller forced himself to sit through the delay as his blurted appeal sped across the light seconds to Rattlesnake and back again. All he could do was stare at the comm screen, at the face of the man who'd just condemned himself to death. Finally, the reply came.
"My mind is made up, Admiral Teller. The weight of point defense those Estes mount individually is cancelling out our fire control advantage, especially in light of the fact that our data-linked point defense is useless against their capital force beams. So I'm resolved to take point defense out of the equation entirely by taking the battleships into ranges where their missiles can be used in sprint mode."
"Sir, they've already put 12 super-dreadnoughts into this system, and there's no sign they've stopped coming. You can't stop them."
Ordinarily, he wouldn't have dreamed of saying that to Anthony Villiers, but times had ceased to be ordinary.
"Of course not, Admiral Teller," Villiers' time-lagged response came in a shockingly mild tone. "With the forces we have available, the idea of stopping them cannot enter our tactical calculations, can it? My objective is to inflict the maximum possible damage on them, hopefully enough to make them pause in their advance. Your responsibility—"
After succeeding to overall command, he did not add, "will be to gain Commodore Reichman enough time to complete the evacuation of Planet A-2. And now," he concluded, "I'll sign off. Good luck, Admiral."
"Good luck, sir."
Teller barely had time to make the meaningless noise before the screen went dark. Then he turned to the tactical display's swarming points of light. The green ones representing Villiers' battleships were crawling towards the purple circle that denoted the Golan warp point, still expelling the red dots of enemy super dreadnoughts in a kind of horrid ejaculation.
"Admiral," Francesca Santarelli interrupted his thoughts.
The intelligence officer had been here aboard the command battlecruiser Sorcerer when the attack had begun, and was now an ad hoc addition to Teller's staff.
"These latest super dreadnoughts to emerge are a new class, judging from some subtle differences in their energy signatures."
"A new class, Commander?" Teller queried, preoccupied.
"Yes, sir. The first dozen belong to one of the classes we encountered at Golan. What we've seen of their weapons mix confirmed with our initial identification. But these coming now are something else."
"Give those conclusions to the computer, Commander. I want this different class tagged so they show up in the plot."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Presently, thin red circles appeared around the newly arriving dots, and as Villiers' battle line closed in, Teller began to notice something. The survivors of the earlier super-dreadnought waves continued to target the battleships with their force beams, but from the haloed newcomers, no fire came. Worried, Teller turned to a small screen flanking his command chair's shock frame. It showed the exterior view from a pickup on Villiers' flagship. As usual, not much could be seen of space combat, such were the distances across which it was waged. But the coming clash of capital ships, at what passed for point-blank range, promised to be more visually stimulating than most. Here and there were the flashes of detonating warheads as Villiers' missiles smashed at their targets in uninterceptable sprint mode. Lasers were, of course, invisible in vacuum, as force beams were anywhere. Glancing at the TAC display, Teller saw that the battling heavyweights were passing very close indeed now. In fact, the dots of Rattlesnake and a hostile were almost brushing against each other on the plot. He looked back to his private screen and thought, with a faint prickling of the neck, that the stupendous enemy ship would be visible were there light from a nearby sun for it to reflect. There, maybe that was it, occluding a tiny segment of the dense star fields. Almost too swiftly for Teller to catch, what looked like coherent lightning flashed from the enemy ship to a point just to the left of the pickup, not far away on Rattlesnake's hull. As Teller blinked his dazzled eyes, the universe as revealed by the pickup shook and lurched violently, and then went out. Teller's stunned silence lasted less than a heartbeat. "Calm," he roared. "Raise Rattlesnake at once."
"No can do, sir," came the comm officer's harried voice. "They must have taken a serious hit. Their communications array is out."
"Keep trying," Teller whirled on Santarelli. "What in God's name was that thing?"
"Unknown, sir."
The intelligence officer sounded as shaken as Teller imagined he himself did.
"It happened too fast for any kind of analysis, but we're getting reports from some of the other battleships, and some of them are downloading some meaningful data."
She studied that data while Teller watched with horror as one after another of the green dots in the TAC display began to flicker and then vanish.
"Sir," Santarelli reported after a time, "we've got enough readouts now. That weapon has a hellacious emission signature. For some tentative conclusions, what we're looking at seems to project a bolt of plasma contained in an electromagnetic bottle."
"But that's crazy," blurted Teller's own staff spook. Lieutenant Tran's feelings about being shouldered aside by a visiting lieutenant commander made him even more argumentative than the theory itself would have. "That mag bottle couldn't hold together for more than an infinitesimal amount of time after leaving its generator."
"Infinitesimal might be a little strong, Lieutenant," Santarelli retorted. "But in essence, you're right, since the fact that it's near light speed makes it workable as a short-range weapon. And within that range, it must be almost like a directional fusion bomb."
"Couldn't point defense disrupt the mag bottle?" Tran asked in a more subdued tone.
"In theory, yes, but it would be like shooting at a missile in sprint mode. Easier to detect, granted, but also even faster, hence even less tracking time." "In fact," Santarelli fell silent, staring at the TAC display.
Teller followed her gaze and saw the flickering green dot that represented Rattlesnake and all the friends she must have aboard her had vanished.
I think you're in command now, sir, she whispered.
Teller tore his eyes away from the hollow tank and its tale of disaster, and addressed the comm officer levelly.
Comm, I want you to patch me through to all the carriers and all the presently deployed fighters you can reach. Tell the carrier skippers to put me on intercom.
Aye, aye, sir.
It didn't take long, and Teller only had a moment to gather his thoughts, as he watched the three battleships still able to do so swing away in an attempt to escape. The ringed scarlet sigils of enemy super-dreadnoughts moved in pursuit, as still more of the behemoths continued to emerge from the warp point, and emerge, and emerge.
Ready, sir, Comm reported.
This is Admiral Teller speaking. Since Admiral Villiers is unable to communicate...
True, as far as it goes, some ghastly voice jibed inside him.
I am assuming command of the task force. I will be blunt with you. Our objective, the only objective we can allow ourselves to even contemplate achieving, is to delay the enemy as long as possible. Every minute we can buy for Commodore Reichman means hundreds of civilian lives. I intend to press home fighter strikes to the limits of our ability, while holding the carriers just outside capital missile range on a vector designed to draw the enemy away from Planet A2.
He paused for breath, then started to say more.
But what more do you say to pilots you've just declared a forlorn hope, and carrier crews you've just declared bait?
That is all, he finished.
The fleet completed its destruction of the enemy battle line and shook down on its new vector. The small attack craft were no surprise this time, and the fleet had learned much from its previous encounter with them. It knew they must come to it, and that it lacked the speed to overtake the motherships from which they operated. The fleet could not reach their bases, and so it made no attempt to. It would kill the attack craft as they closed, accepting its own losses to wear them away. And in the meantime, the plethora of comm signals and powerful energy sources clustered around the life-bearing planet ahead of the fleet, whispered that a better target than ships it could not kill awaited it. Flight after flight of fighters struck, returned to rearm, and struck again. They soon learned the enemy's plasma weapon was deadly to fighters, yet they couldn't stay beyond its limited range. The enemy capital ships carried too much point defense for FM-2s to penetrate. That left them the sole option of flying into the throats of those hell weapons in order to strike home with the Frams no point defense had time to stop. And they did it. Over and over they did it. Teller watched from Sorcerer's flag bridge, and nausea warred with pride as he saw those splendid young people spend themselves, trading their lives for whatever damage they could do to an enemy they couldn't even visualize, an enemy that seemed but a faceless essence of elemental, inexplicable malevolence. Their losses sickened him, as did the fact that they'd been unable to prevent the destruction of the last of the battleships. Villiers' gallant gesture had sunk without a trace in a bottomless pit of futility. But what sickened him most was the fact that the invaders refused to be sucked into pursuing his carriers and battle cruisers. Like monstrous insects drawn to light, they made their implacable way sunward toward the warmth that might shelter life.
"Their course is gradually pulling them away from us, sir," Santorelli observed.
"I see it is," Teller growled, then ordered himself not to take it out on the intelligence officer. "We'll have to follow them, otherwise the range will widen to the point where we won't be able to conduct fighter strikes. But we'll stay out of missile range."
He seemed to reach a decision, and turned to face his ops officer.
"Commander Deloria, I want a general order sent out to all carriers. The fighters are to spread out their attacks."
"Spread them out, sir."
"Right. Instead of concentrating on one ship and pounding it to pieces, I want to hit as many as possible, inflict just enough damage to slow them down."
He smiled faintly.
"I know it goes against the fighter jocks' training and temperament. They want to go for the kill. But it's as I told them earlier. Our job is to buy time."
"They'll understand, sir."
Deloria was a former fighter jock herself. Orders began to go out. Teller couldn't keep his eyes off the serene, blue-marbled loveliness of Erebor A2 that curved below him, even though he knew it was a lie. The truth was in the screens that showed the endless lines of refugees moving slowly towards the shuttles. At least they were orderly. Too orderly.
Even the children seemed subdued as they shuffled along, clutching favorite toys. Their faces showed little more bewilderment than their parents. Teller shared their feelings. He could hardly have felt a greater sense of unreality if the screens had shown sacrificial victims being led towards a blood-drenched altar, or Jews being herded into gas chambers disguised as showers. Things like this weren't supposed to happen anymore. The truth was also in the comm screen that showed Augustino Reichman's face. The full-fleshed Commodore was generally an embodiment of good-living solidity. Now his haggardness brought home to Teller what was happening in a way the anonymous thousands in the screens could not.
"Jackson, I've got to have more time. I can get them all off this planet. I have the berthing capacity."
Reichman took a deep breath.
"Sorry. I know your people have already done all that was humanly possible to slow them down. But, look, maybe we could speed things up if I could get more people down to the planet. I've got volunteers lined up."
Teller shook his head slowly. His idea for slowing the enemy advance had worked, and as he contemplated the 85% of his fighters he'd lost, he couldn't bring himself to feel the least stir of self-satisfaction. But the 200-plus pilots who'd flown those 127 fighters had bought more time with their lives than he'd dared hope, forcing the enemy fleet to slow its pace to that of its cripples. Teller's battlecruisers and carriers had swept around them in a wide arc, just outside missile range, and proceeded to this planet, where Reichman now had 66% of the colonists aboard his transports, or else in shuttles en route to orbit or ready to lift off. But still the enemy came on. They came slowly, but they came. And Teller, with 4 battlecruisers, 10 nearly empty light carriers, and 13 light combatants, including Reichman's, faced a situation materialized from sheer nightmare. Jackson Teller had never thought of himself as a particularly brave man. Indeed, he'd often wrestled with doubts about the adequacy of his courage. So he'd long ago forced himself to face all the likely ways in which he might be called on to sacrifice his life on the altar of duty. For he was, above all else, a conscientious man, and he needed to know he would be able to call on something to serve in place of whatever quality people meant when they spoke of dash. He'd confronted all his demons and felt he'd stared them down. Now he realized how inadequate his efforts to imagine demons had been. For the decision he must now make rendered the hazarding of his own life almost banal by comparison.
He shook his head again. "No, Augustino, I've got only 23 fighters left and almost no munitions, and as soon as these creatures realize an evacuation's underway, they'll send their undamaged super dreadnoughts ahead at full speed. They must know I can't even put up a pretense of fighting them, and slow as they are, they're as fast as your transports. So if you don't get a head start on them, nobody will be saved." He took a deep breath. "We have to depart for K-45 as soon as we can recover the shuttles, now en route or on the ground. And the ones on the ground have to lift at once." Reichman's round face paled.
"No, by God! A third of the colony's still down there! We can't—"
It seemed to Teller that someone else spoke, in a voice other than his. "You will abort the evacuation now, Commodore, and prepare for immediate departure from this system. That is a direct order, which you may have in writing if you wish." For a full heartbeat, Reichman seemed about to say the unsayable, but the moment passed.
"That won't be necessary, Admiral," he said expressionlessly.
Teller turned away, for he didn't want to look at Reichman's face any longer, and he definitely didn't want to be looking at the view screens when the crowds on the planet's surface heard the announcement that no more passengers would be accepted.
"Commander Deloria."
"Yes, Admiral?"
"Get with Common Engineering. As we proceed to the K-45 warp point, I want to lay a chain of comm buoys. I also want you to pass me through to whoever's in charge on the ground down there."
Teller wasn't looking at Deloria. He seemed to be listening to the low, ugly roar over the pickup audio. The refugees must have heard the announcement.
"You see," he continued quietly, "I want the ground stations to keep broadcasting as long as they can. I want them to report everything they can possibly tell us about whoever or whatever is doing this."
Chapter 6. Slow Them Down.
Attention on deck.
Vanessa Murakuma's green eyes swept her collected flag officers and squadron commanders like fire control lasers as she entered TFNS Cobra's main briefing room with Leroy McKenna, Ling Tian, and Marcus LeBlanc on her heels. The dark-complexioned captain had never bothered to do anything about his receding hairline. Not even Murakuma had ever figured out whether he was simply too busy to bother with such inconsequentials or whether his baldness was its own affectation. But the neatly trimmed beard he'd grown in compensation was an expression-shielding asset for any intelligence officer. Especially today, she thought, as she studied her senior officers' faces. Most were grim and strained, but her own was composed, almost serene. No one had to know how hard it was for her to keep it that way. She crossed to the head of the table and took her seat while her three staffers stood behind the chairs to her right and left.
"Be seated, ladies and gentlemen."
Her soprano was as calm as her face, and a quiet rustle filled the briefing room as her subordinates sat. She tipped back her chair and laid one fine-boned hand on the tabletop. None of them had yet seen the official reports from Erebor, but their faces said they'd heard the rumors, and she drew a deep mental breath.
"I'll come straight to the point," she said. "The enemy, whoever and whatever they are, have taken Erebor."
Someone inhaled at the confirmation.
"We anticipated that. What we did not anticipate was the destruction of Admiral Villiers' entire battle line."
A sort of electric shock ran around the table, and she continued in that same quiet voice.
"Captain LeBlanc and Commander Ling will bring you up to speed on our best current information in a moment, but I want each of you to understand what this means."
She paused a moment, as if to let them brace themselves, then continued flatly.
"The federal government has activated the mutual assistance clauses of our treaties with the Orions and Ophiuchi Association. Both of our treaty partners have promised assistance and begun redeploying their own units, but neither they nor any substantial numbers of our own units can reach us for many weeks. In short, we're it, and we're out of time. As you know, our original orders were that while Admiral Villiers screened the approaches, we were to hold station here in Sarasota to assemble our entire assigned order of battle before advancing. That's no longer possible. We must advance now, immediately, to K-45 to cover the evacuation of Meriwether. All indications are that it will be at least another 2 months, possibly three, before we can be sufficiently reinforced to think about actually stopping the enemy. What we can and must do is slow him down. Sky Marshal Avram's instructions are unequivocal. We must buy time to evacuate as much of the Meriwether and Justin populations as we can, yet we must do so without suffering crippling losses of our own. We're all there is, ladies and gentlemen, and you all know how hard it's been to scrape up even this many ships. If we allow ourselves to be destroyed, the reinforcements currently en route will, in all probability, be too little to stop the enemy short of Romulus, or even Belcasa, and it will be at least another 2 months before follow-on units can reinforce them. Which means, she turned her head, sweeping them all with cold, still eyes, that if it becomes a choice between heavy fleet losses or abandoning populated worlds, we will have no choice but to withdraw.
An almost sound of protest swept the table, but those dark jade eyes froze it back into stillness. Every officer in that compartment knew the TFN tradition. The fleet died before it abandoned civilians. That wasn't policy. It was a matter of duty, honor, and pride. But they also knew she was right. That wouldn't save them from the poisonous guilt they would feel. But they knew she was right.
"Very well, then."
She let her chair slip forward, laid both hands on the table, and looked at her ops officer.
"Commander Ling?"
"Yes, sir."
Ling was the most junior officer present, but her dark eyes met those of the assembled admirals, commodores, and captains levelly as she brought her terminal online.
"We have a reasonably complete report from Admiral Teller," she began. "Most of his carrier group and its escorts survived, but his strike groups took catastrophic losses. Of the 149 fighters with which he began the engagement, 23 survived."
Rear Admiral Waldeck, Murakuma's second in command, flinched visibly, but Ling continued in her most clinical voice.
"The good news, such as it is that the enemy still has not employed fighters, SBMs, SBM Hawk missile pods, or second-generation antimatter warheads. Coupled with our more sophisticated data link, we continue to hold an overwhelming advantage in long-range actions. With anything approaching equality of forces, we should be able to stop these people cold. As it is, we estimate the tonnage loss is as much as 4-1 in our favor, and they still keep coming. Captain LeBlanc, she nodded at the intelligence officer, will address this point, but my own concern is with the immediate operational consequences rather than the enemy's motives. Her eyes dipped to her terminal screen, then rose once more. The bad news is that the enemy has demonstrated both a new tactic and a previously unknown weapon, which in combination brought about the destruction of Admiral Villiers' battle line. Without SBM Hawks, he seems to have adopted another approach to assaulting a warp point, a simultaneous transit. Captain LeBlanc and I are still analyzing the record, but it appears the enemy has built an entire fleet component of cruiser-sized vessels expressly to mount mass transits to clear his battle line's way. Obviously, his losses from interpenetration will be considerable, but it allows him to introduce a massive amount of firepower quickly. No one in TF-58 anticipated such a tactic. When it was actually employed, Admiral Villiers felt he had no option but to close, at which point he discovered the existence of the enemy's new weapon system. For want of a better name, we're calling it a plasma gun. Our tech people don't know yet how the enemy projects a containment field to hold it together, but they estimate that it must be quite short-ranged compared to conventional energy weapons. Unfortunately, it's also extremely powerful. And from the numbers of plasma guns a single SD apparently mounts, it must be considerably less massive than our own energy weapons. We're trying to formulate doctrine for dealing with it, but it combines the nastier features of a sprint-mode missile and an energy weapon. High accuracy over its range, massive destructiveness, and a velocity too great for effective point defense engagement. At the moment, the only real advice we can give is to stay out of its envelope. She paused and flicked her eyes over her terminal once more, then looked back up. I've prepared a download of Admiral Teller's data for you and your staffs. My assistants and I are continuing our own analysis of it. By the time we arrive in K-45, we should be prepared to discuss it in much greater detail, but any additional input will be most appreciated.
She sat back, and Murakuma looked to her left.
Captain LeBlanc.
Yes, sir. The newly arrived intelligence officer produced a crooked smile.
What we seem to have here, ladies and gentlemen, is something out of a bad novel.
One or two officers actually surprised themselves with barks of laughter.
Even Murakuma smiled briefly, but then LeBlanc leaned forward, and there was no humor at all in his deep-set brown eyes.
Even with this new plasma weapon, our technological advances are surely as evident to the enemy as they are to us. As Commander Ling just pointed out, the loss ratio is overwhelmingly in our favor, and seems likely to remain so. Yet the enemy continues to throw super dreadnoughts at us, and now he's added this assault fleet component. All humor aside, I never actually expected to run into the Orglon Empire, but that seems to be exactly what's happening. To date, we haven't been able to examine any enemy wreckage or databases to get any idea of his psychology, so all we can do is make inferences from his tactics. And those inferences aren't good.
The briefing room was deathly still, and he cocked his chair back slightly.
First, and of the greatest immediate concern, he's far less sensitive to losses than we are. I submit that no Terran admiral would continue to advance this aggressively after suffering such heavy and one-sided casualties. Quite aside from morale damage, the cost in terms of lost hardware would make it unthinkable. I suppose we might postulate that this sort of behavior reflects how close we are to what must be one of their most important star systems, if not their home system itself. If Sol were under threat, no doubt Homefleet would be willing to accept mammoth losses to push the enemy back. And it's possible these people are driving so hard to build defensive depth before we can bring up our main strength. Tempting as that explanation may be, however, I do not believe it to be correct. Or to be more accurate, the second salient point about their operations convinces me it's not the entire answer.
Second point, Captain? Waldeck asked quietly.
Yes, sir. These people never even attempted to communicate with Commodore Braun before opening fire.
Not even the Rigelians began a full-fledged war against the Federation without at least attempting to evaluate us first. These people simply started shooting. By our own standards, or those of any other race we've previously encountered, that sort of reaction is insane, which suggests the xenologists are going to have a hard time figuring out what makes them tick. Obviously, an inability to understand what motivates them will make it extremely difficult to project their probable actions. But it's very tempting, so far at least, to assume that this violent aggressiveness, more even than our proximity to a nodal system, underlies their strategy to date. Perhaps even more to the point, we have this assault fleet component. Think about that for a minute.
As Admiral Murakuma herself pointed out to me years ago, no reasonable race would sacrifice hundreds of capital ships in headlong assaults on a succession of defended warp points.
Against warp points they knew were critical to their opponent, yes. Perhaps they would do that if it was the only way to break through. But simple mathematics would make that unthinkable as a routine tactic. It takes us the better part of 2 standard years to build an SD, completely ignoring the question of training a capital ship's crew. No one can afford to expend that big a chunk of industrial output without a good reason. These people, however, seem to have found an approach they think is cost-effective. There's no way to prove it, yet, but Commander Ling's initial analysis agrees with mine. The ships they used for that simultaneous transit were purpose-built. Whatever we don't know about our enemy's psychology, we've been given very convincing evidence that they're willing to accept massive losses in light units, which can be replaced in a much shorter time frame, to clear the way for their heavies. To me, at least, this suggests we can expect to see suicide tactics on the Rigelian or Theban model, and I advise all of you to be on the lookout for them. Finally, I'd like to return to the losses in capital ships which they have so far accepted, which suggests we have to assume an industrial base at least as large as our own. Someone made a sound of disagreement, and LeBlanc smiled grimly. I realize we're accustomed to considering the Federation's industrial capacity as unmatched in the galaxy. To date, we've had every reason to think just that. But could we expend so many SDs to capture what are obviously colonies, not core systems? Let me stress once more that however ferocious he may be, the enemy still has to build the starships he's using up. More, he has to realize we're still redeploying to meet him, that we may have a much greater strength to throw at him than he's seen yet. In similar circumstances, our response would be to use probing forces we could afford to lose. We certainly wouldn't cut our mobile forces to the bone in offensive operations that left us unable to meet counterattacks. While we dare not assume our own idea of logic governs these people, I find it very difficult to believe we're that different. And if we aren't, their losses to date must represent an acceptable loss rate, which in turn suggests they have enormous reserves of capital ships. And for that to be true, they have to have an industrial base capable of building them in the first place. LeBlanc shrugged, and more than one of the grim faces around the table paled. The enemy's insensitivity to losses had been a tactical concern, but the Federation's status as the most productive civilization in galactic history was so fundamentally accepted by non-humans as well as humans that few of them had gotten around to considering what LeBlanc had just said. It simply wasn't possible for anyone to outproduce them, was it?
Murakuma let them live with the implications for a few moments, then cleared her throat.
We can't know if Captain LeBlanc is correct, but the consequences of overestimating an enemy are certainly less likely to be fatal than those of underestimating him. And whether he's correct or not, our concern has to be slowing these people down until the rest of Battlefleet can respond.
Several people nodded, and she smiled a thin, cold smile.
Very well, then. Since we do seem to possess the technological edge at the moment, I suggest we decide how best to use it. Commander Ling's current analysis of the Erebor action is available on your terminals. Please take 15 or 20 minutes to peruse it. After that, her smile was colder and thinner than ever, the floor will be open for suggestions.
Vanessa Murakuma sat in her palatial day cabin and watched a display with empty green eyes.
K-45 was no more than an empty spot where 3 warp lines met, and the massed ships of Task Force 59, Terran Federation Navy, held station on TFNS Cobra as she floated in that emptiness. It was a powerful force. 12 battleships, 20 battle cruisers, and 12 light carriers plus escorts, and she supposed she should be excited to have it under her flag. Yet she felt no elation. She'd fought all her life to exercise an authority just like this one, and now, as she faced the hideous decisions that authority was about to force upon her, all she felt was a sick, gnawing need to pass it on to someone, anyone else. She killed the display, blanking away the light dots of the thousands of human beings waiting to live or die at her orders, and her face twisted as her eye fell on the innocent-looking data chip on her desk. She stared at it, bile churning in the back of her throat, then drew a deep breath and made herself look away as her cabin's entry chime sounded. She squared her shoulders, forcing the sick despair from her expression, and pressed the admittance stud. The hatch slid open, and the officers she'd asked to join her walked through it. Rear Admiral Teller led the way, followed by Demosthenes Waldeck, Leroy McKenna, and Marcus LeBlanc. The four of them sat in the comfortable chairs facing her desk at her gesture, and she made herself pick up the data chip.
"Thank you for coming, gentlemen."
Her flat voice sounded over-controlled even to her, but it was the only one she had.
"I assume you've all viewed the visual records from Erebor?"
Heads nodded, and she felt a stab of sympathy for Teller's haunted eyes. It wasn't his fault. He'd gotten everyone he possibly could out, yet it made no difference to his bitter self-loathing.
And Murakuma understood only too well.
Just as she knew it would make no difference to her own when the time came. She studied his face for a moment, then cleared her throat.
"Before we continue, Admiral Teller, I'd like to thank you for your efforts in Erebor."
Dull surprise flickered in the junior admiral's eyes, and she faced him directly.
"I can only imagine what you're feeling, Jackson," she said quietly. "I'm very much afraid that will change shortly, and I'll be honest with you, with all of you,"
she let her eyes sweep over the others,
"and admit that terrifies me. It terrifies all of us now."
Her hand tightened on the data chip.
"But we can't admit that. We have to put it away somewhere deep inside and pretend it isn't there. Because if we don't, if we let it show and affect our personnel, or even worse, paralyze us—"
She shook her head. The others looked back without speaking, but Waldeck nodded curtly. Demosthenes Waldeck came from one of the most powerful of the corporate world dynasties which ruled the Federation.
And many of Murakuma's fellow fringers, including her own chief of staff, were prepared to hate him for that.
Despite the Federation military's long-standing tradition of political neutrality, the festering hatred between the fringe, which produced an ever-growing percentage of the fleet's total manpower, and the corporate worlds, had spilled over into the Navy.
And that saddened Murakuma.
She understood it, and watching the corporate world politico's cynical manipulation of political power disgusted her. Yet she felt something precious and irreplaceable slipping away from the fleet. It was like virginity, she thought sadly, that sense of something special and almost holy, of being a fellowship of arms whose dedication to protect and preserve placed it above political factionalism and pettiness, could never be regained once it was lost. Even worse, it sowed distrust, and that was something the human race simply could not afford. She and Leroy McKenna had come as close to a shouting match over that as they ever had, for McKenna was from Shiloh, whose economy had been devastated 50 years back for daring to defy a major corporate world shipping line. The Liberal Progressive Party had enacted special legislation to clarify the dispute between the system government and Transstellar Shipping, and McKenna's family was one of the many who'd been paupered by its provisions. Expecting him ever to forgive the corporate worlds for that was not only unreasonable, but wrong.
Yet Murakuma had no option but to insist that he put it aside in his new position.
Especially, she thought, in this case.
For all the Waldeck clan's immense power, it was also one of those confusing families whose members sometimes refused to fit neat stereotypes, and Demosthenes's branch had a habit of producing outstanding naval officers. His grandmother, Minerva Waldeck, the mother of Terran carrier ops, had been a heroine of ISW-3, one of the greatest officers ever to wear the TFN's black and silver.
Murakuma had known Demosthenes for years, and none knew better than she that he was cut from the same cloth as his grandmother.
Even McKenna was coming to accept that, almost against his will, and after Teller's, Waldeck's face was the grimmest in her cabin. The massive Waldeck jaw clenched, and his eyes were shadowed, but his deep, measured voice was level when he spoke.
"You're right, sir. We can't allow this to paralyze us. But with all due respect, it has to affect our planning. I realize we can't afford to take heavy losses, but we're talking about millions of lives. We've got to slow these bastards down enough to get as many out as we possibly can."
McKenna's strong-nosed black face wore a strange expression as he looked at the Admiral.
Under other circumstances, Murakuma would have been pleased to see Leroy realize Demosthenes was as determined to save Fringers as he would have been to save corporate worlders. But there was no room in her for pleasure this day.
"Agreed," she replied, "and that's why I'm so grateful to Jackson. If he hadn't preserved his command, we'd have only 4 carriers, not 12. And if he hadn't laid the commsat chain from Erebor, we wouldn't know what was happening to the people we didn't get out." She looked back to Teller, and her voice was soft. "I realize pulling out of Erebor was a hard decision. I know it's going to haunt you, and I know a lot of second-guessers who weren't there and didn't have to make the call will suggest all sorts of clever ways you could have avoided it. I happen to believe you did exactly the right thing, and I've so advised Sky Marshal Avram."
"Thank you."
Teller's tenor was low and hoarse. She heard the genuine gratitude in it, but she also heard the strain, and his hands trembled visibly before he gripped them together in his lap.
"If I'd had even a few more fighters left, or maybe if they'd hadn't been bringing up still more SDs."
His voice trailed off, and his nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply. "You did the right thing," she said again, stressing the measured words, then leaned back with a sigh and dropped the chip on her desk. "Nonetheless, Demosthenes is also correct. We know what the stakes are now."
All of them nodded this time, and Murakuma shuddered as her mind insisted on replaying the chip yet again.
Some of the Erebor ground stations had survived long enough to transmit footage of the enemy's landings and activities via Teller's chain of commsats. They'd seen the enemy now, and she'd felt a shiver of pure, atavistic horror at her first sight of them. They looked, she thought, like some obscene alloy of spider and starfish, 8-limbed, hairy monstrosities that moved with a hideous, flowing, tarantula-like gait. Humanity had encountered other life forms at least as strange to human eyes, but none of them had ever awakened such a sense of instant, instinctive hatred as these creatures did. It was as if they resonated somehow with humankind's darkest phobias, and their behavior on Erebor only validated that hatred. The xenologists had dubbed them arachnids, and the current best guess was that they were carnivores. It was only a guess, but whether they were pure meat-eaters or not was beside the point. The Federation would never know who'd been behind the camera which transmitted the horrifying footage, for the transmission had ended with terrifying abruptness as one of the aliens loomed suddenly before the lens. But humanity owed whoever it had been a debt beyond any price, for he'd caught them feeding. Without that footage, mankind would not have known that these aliens regarded humans as a food source. Vomit rose in her throat once more, and she wondered if the government would dare release the imagery. A part of her hoped it would be forever sealed, but she knew better. Sooner or later it would be released, or leaked, or stolen, and every living human would know what she knew now. For all their long, segmented, spider-like legs, the aliens massed no more than half again as much as humans, and they preferred their food living. That made children just the right size for—
Vanessa Murakuma clenched her fist and thrust the memories violently aside,
then made herself look at McKenna and LeBlanc. "I've just received a response to our dispatch to Sarasota," she said as normally as she could. "They agree with our assessment. In order to evacuate the maximum possible numbers from Meriwether and Justin, we'll have to use Sarasota as the collection point. We simply don't have enough lift capacity to take them any further back, and even stopping at Sarasota, we're never going to get everyone out."
"How soon can they get additional transports to us, sir?"
McKenna asked quietly.
"Not soon enough," Murakuma's voice was flat, and she pinched the bridge of her nose.
What Reichman has now is everything in the sector. Even for a hop as short as the one to the Sarasota fleet base, we simply don't have enough personnel lift. Admiral Eusebio has authorized me, she smiled bleakly, to use my discretion in utilizing what we do have.